My name is Logan Court, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. I would like to take a moment to acknowledge that we are gathered here today on land where the indigenous peoples of the Susquehannock, the Shawnee, and the Lenape made their homes for 10,000 years prior to European settlement. On behalf of the Clark Forum, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year, the Department of Athletics, the Office of Student Leadership and Campus Engagement, I would like to welcome you to tonight's event, Just Run. This is the first event in the Clark Forum's The Good Life series, in which we aim to benefit from the insights of discipline and to think about our individual and collective goals and aspirations relating to a good life. We have most likely all run at some point in our lives. For some of us, like myself, it was definitely begrudgingly. For some, running is more than just a workout or a high school sport. Running is a lifestyle. For a growing population of Americans, it is a lifestyle that is hard to give up. Just last year, Julia the Hurricane Hawkins, who is 104, broke the 60-meter dash world record, alongside her teammate Orville Rogers, who was 100 when he broke the 60-meter dash record in just over 19 seconds. Rogers had stopped running for some time and took it back up again when he was 50, very similar to this evening's speaker. My inclination towards competition is definitely not through running. I'm a competitive swimmer and have been for the past 15 years. Like our speaker this evening, I tend towards distance, competing in the 1,000-yard freestyle and the mile in my college career, and open water 5Ks and 10Ks during the summers. The feeling of putting my head into a swim and focusing solely on what I'm doing is completely unmatched in any other aspect of my life. Now, whether I will be swimming at the age of 70 is still to be seen. Gene Dykes is a lifelong runner. Recently, his preference has been for long distances, with him mostly focusing on marathons, while also competing in 100 and 200-mile races. He's had an extensive running career in the past 13 years, holding 14 national age group records and winning 15 national titles. Just this past Sunday, Dykes participated in the New York City Marathon and won first place in his age group. And last December, in Jacksonville, Florida, Dykes ran a marathon time of 2 hours, 54 minutes, and 23 seconds, besting the previous world record for the 70 to 74 age group by 25 seconds. However, the course that Dykes was running on had not been sanctioned, so the record, however, stands as unofficial. But that does not matter too much to Dykes, who focuses on his philosophy of just run. There will be a question and answer session immediately following the program, so please hold all questions until that time. And the Clark Forum welcomes differences of opinion expressed politely, thoughtfully, and succinctly. Disruptive behavior or harassment of the speakers, members of the Dickinson community, or audience members will not be tolerated. As a show of respect for our speaker and everyone in attendance, please stay until the end of the program, including the question and answer section. And at this time, I ask you please silence all cell phones and other electronic devices in the event of an emergency. Please know that handicap accessible exits are located on the west side of this building. And now please join me in welcoming our guest, Gene Dykes.
Well, everybody knows I love to talk about running, and nothing like having a captive audience like this. I go to cocktail parties and start talking about running, and all of a sudden drinks need to be topped off and hors d'oeuvres need to be found. But I keep trying, talking up people at cocktail parties. Anyway, just this past spring, I was talking to a guy who had his farthest run before had been a marathon. I said, there's this 50-miler you got to try. And so a great success. I talked to a cocktail party guy into running a 50-miler, and he really loved it. So I expect half you people to go home and sign up for a 50-miler as soon as you get back. But my running began, it was 1961 or so, and it just popped into my head one day. I think I'll go for a run. And this was back before running was a thing. Fix wrote a famous book that kickstarted the running boom. This was before then. I don't recall ever seeing anybody run before then. And I went out and, the dogs went berserk. You know, they never saw a thing like that. People would stop and stare. And if I was wearing my sweatsuit, they would say, why are you running in your pajamas? You know, it's just, you know, they just totally, totally alien. So let's get. So the title of the book is Why is Just Run? And Why did I pick that phrase? It has a lot of meanings to me, and I'll hope to touch on most of them today. But first off, it's just a play on words, so to speak, because I run in a running group where everybody has a handle. And they asked me what they wanted my handle to be. And I said, well, a lot of times people will call me Eugene. And I have to tell them, no, it's just Gene. And so that became my handle, Just Gene. So they want me to write a book now, and it will be Just Run by Just Gene. So, and so yeah, that book, the book, you know, the book's probably something I'll never get around to writing, but a lot of this talk will be based around chapters that I would write if I ever did get around to it. Or each chapter would have a different meaning of what it means to just run. Yeah, it takes me a while. You can see I'm not used to this yet. So why just run? Well, I'll be talking about a lot of themes, getting out of your comfort zone, ignoring conventional wisdom. I love destroying conventional wisdom. We'll do a lot of that. And enhancing health and lifestyle. Oh, but first, most people say, how did you get to be a runner? Well, I've already mentioned once that it just happened as a thing. I just went out on a whim, and so I liked it. I don't know why it hurt so much, but so I would run just for fun. And I thought I'd recap my running history in terms of geological time frames. I'm not sure why, but it sounded like a good idea. I thought I'd run with it. I mean, who doesn't like some dinosaur references in a talk? You know? So we'll get to those. So here are the main eras. There's the Paleozoic, when I was growing up. The Triassic, high school and college. The Jurassic, grad school and early working years. Cretaceous and Cenozoic. Cenozoic is everything after the Cretaceous, you know, when the asteroid came down and wiped out the dinosaurs. So, but similar to geological eras and periods, there was usually some significant event which brought the previous era to a close, and that exact same thing will be mirrored in my history. The end of one to the beginning of another. So let's take a look at the first era. The Paleozoic, that's when I was 0 to 13. The parallel here is that during the Paleozoic era, there wasn't anything living on land. Everything was sea life. It might have been a few years there where things were crawling out of the slime. But that's significant because if there was no land life, there was no running. And if there's no running, it was a very boring time to live. So unless you were a swimmer. Yeah, a lot of good opportunities there. So what was the bang that ended that era? Well, the bang that ended that era was that first run. So that launched me into the Triassic period. See, I told you there'd be dinosaurs. So early on in high school, I just ran. Just like I always did, I'd sometimes, you know, get on my sneakers and head out for a run. And but it seemed natural to run track. So my senior year, I joined the track team and I ran the 2-mile event. And I thought, holy cow, I am really good at this. And you know, I was winning all the dual meets. I found out later on that it was because it was the first year the 2-mile was run, and all the good runners ran the mile. So I found that out when I got to college, where I started out running the 2-mile, the mile, and the half mile, and I was, you know, totally expecting to take the college scene by storm. But it turned out that everybody whooped me. My teammates, opponents, everybody just totally blew me off the track. And my coach hated me because, you know, I told him I was some hotshot distance runner. But It turned out to be a successful career. I taught myself to high jump, triple jump, and do the intermediate hurdles, and I got a lot of points that way. So I got out of college. That, of course, is the big bang that ends this era. Now we get to the Jurassic period, which was post-college. So what did I do with running post-college? Well, I'm a competitive person, and it had been firmly impressed upon me that in college, I wasn't any good, and I didn't want to compete at things I wasn't good at. So I stuck with the sports I knew I was good at, golf and bowling. And I assure you, I had just as much passion for golf and bowling back then as I do for running now. And those satisfied my instincts. I suppose I got ready for a running career because bowling, I don't know, just had a hard time finding a league I liked, so I quit, even though I was at the highest average I ever had. In golf, unfortunately, I didn't have that trajectory. My golf game was getting so terrible that I couldn't compete anymore. And so I was ready to do something new. So the big bang there was to get into this era. And this is something for, well, you college-age guys, you can do this. But for everybody who gets a little older, never sprint. The end of that era came when I decided to sprint in at the end of a workout with a guy. And I tore my hamstring at the insertion point, and I couldn't run for 6 years after that. I mean, it was just terrible. Every year I would try to go out again, and the pain would be too terrible. But after 6 years, you know, I ran into some guys that encouraged me to get out there again. And after running with them on several weekends, they said, "Well, come on, you ought to do some races with us." So, all right, give it a try, but I'm not very good. And so I did this trail race. It was a 7-mile trail race, and it was so gonzo. I mean, within 100 yards, we're running through the woods, over stumps and leaves and rocks and roots, and it was just so much fun. And a few weeks later, then I ran my first road race, which was the Caesar Rodney Half Marathon in Wilmington. Several things were important about that. One was that at the half marathon, I ran a fast enough half marathon that I could bypass the lottery at New York City. And all my friends were going to run it. So they said, "Well, you have to run the New York City Marathon with us." And I said, "Well, all right, I'm not ready to run a marathon, but maybe I can be by the fall." But the other thing is, based on those first two races, ever since then, at first subconsciously and then later consciously, on trails, I always tried to go further each year than I had run on trails before. And on roads, I vowed I would go a little faster each year than I did the year before. It was really set up by those two races. And in fact, that's what happened over the next 7 years. I was very gradually improved. I was happy. You know, I started my first race at 58, and by age 65, you know, I had dropped my marathon time from 3:40 to, you know, down around 3:20. And on trails, I started doing adventure runs, and I don't think I'd done my first 100-miler quite yet, but I was working on it. I certainly had done a 50. And then the big bang moment came again to end this era. And essentially, it was the same big bang as the asteroid. I mean, it just totally blew away the rest of my running career. It was a total revelation. I went to the Toronto Marathon and stunk up the joint. After showing years of improvement, I failed in my first attempt to run a faster marathon than I had the year before. So I decided that if I had to find out whether or not I was any good, I would have to hire a coach. And I'd always resisted that notion because What's a coach going to do? He's going to tell you how to run. And, you know, I felt like, who doesn't know how to run? It'd just be a waste of money. But let's get into the Cenozoic era, which includes everything up till now, hence the woolly mammoth. And just like mammals were free to evolve after the dinosaurs were wiped out, my running career was free to evolve based on the kind of fitness my coach brought to me. It didn't take long before I was doing things that had just been totally inconceivable the year before. And, I guarantee you, when I first hired my coach, I didn't think any of these things would happen. 2 years ago, I ran 3 200-mile races, one each month, August, September, and October. He so generously mentioned, I got a whole bunch of national championships, age group records. I've won my age group at Boston 4 straight years. And finally, that marathon world age group record that I beat. That wasn't in my sights a year and a half ago. It was just, all this stuff is just way beyond me. And, it's led to me being here, which is totally, totally inconceivable. I still can't get used to it. I kid you not, going to Jacksonville, I had trained to break the world record because that was my training goal. It really motivated me. I said, I'm going to train and try and break the world record. And I didn't care whether I held the world record. I just wanted to break it. And I didn't tell anybody I was going down there to break the world record. I just thought, well, if I do, I'll just post a little message on Facebook and I'll get a little congratulations. And within a minute of finishing the race, all of a sudden, the story exploded. I have no idea why. It was just, people were calling and radio and TV and speaking engagements, and I'm still just totally overwhelmed because, I'm just an old guy out there having fun. All right, enough of that. Let's get down to just run. So just run 101 are the reasons to just run. One reason is no reason at all. That was, my first run. I think I'll go for a run. Actually, I'm lying. I think there was a girl involved. There was a girl who lived about 2.5 miles away, and I said, I'll just run over there. And it was a disaster from two standpoints. The first disaster was I got about a mile and had to start walking. And I was really ashamed of myself for that. Second disaster, of course, was the girl wasn't very impressed. So the other reasons, which I'll get into in more depth, is getting out of your comfort zone, ignoring conventional wisdom. And we'll look at those now. Okay, how can you get out of your comfort zone? Well, there's so many ways. A lot of people restrict themselves to the surfaces they run on. Most people run on roads. And to people who only run on roads, I encourage them to get out there and run on the trail. You might really like it. Try and get one where you're, isn't too technical and you're not likely to fall down. Not that anything could go wrong. I only broke my shoulder and cracked a rib this year. But other than that, it's perfectly safe. Some people really like just running on the track. Amazing, just run around and around in circles. And that's kind of leads into the second one, or the third one we'll get to in a second. Topography, Some people only like flat. Some people only like hilly. Get out of your comfort zone. Run hills if you only run on the flat. Topology, this is more like a racing thing. Some people just will run one kind. Believe it or not, I had a friend who didn't like point to point because it involved turning around at one end. He says, you lose time turning around. And he hated the Philadelphia Marathon because it had 3 turnarounds. Just amazing what some people will used to choose races. Another guy, he was a really good 200 miler on the trail, and I said, you know, you should enter this one race. It's, you know, I think you could win it. He says, oh yeah, what is it? And I said, well, you run a 1 mile loop over and over and over again. And he says, oh, that's a gerbil race. You know, he says, I don't do gerbil races. But all races have their advantage. For instance, in a gerbil race, unlike races where aid might be few and far between, you keep coming back to your own personal stash or the aid station and the finish line just over and over again. It couldn't be anything more easy logistically than doing one of these short loop races. Geography. A lot of people just don't think about running in distant lands. They just stick to local. Naturally, I don't. I really look forward to my national races and my international races. And I'll talk a little later about how to combine those in your lifestyle. How else can you get out of your comfort zone? Well, a lot of people won't go out if it's raining. They won't go out if it's snowing or too cold or too hot. I'm kind of reminded of a golfer once who was interviewed. He had just won a tournament. And they said, well, it was so windy out there this whole tournament. You must really like it in the wind. He said, oh, yeah, you know, I just love playing golf in the wind. And then, right, but he says, you won last year, too, and there wasn't any wind. He says, oh, I love it when there's no wind. You know, you got to love whatever it's out there. And if it's hot, cold, dry, wet, so it doesn't matter. I'm out there running. And distance. A lot of times I'll see on Facebook, people will query the internet and say, am I ready to run a marathon yet? And it never occurred to me to ask somebody if I was ready. If I wanted to sign up for something, you know, I signed up for it. You definitely just run. The queen of just running, I met at the Rocky Raccoon 100. A common thing to do when you're running 100 is you fall in temporarily with somebody, and they'll say, well, you know, how many hundreds have you done, or is this your first one? She says, oh, yeah, this is my first 100. And she says, in fact, she says, I've never run more than 13 miles in my life. She had never, I didn't believe her. I went home and looked her up on, you know, some sites, and in fact, she had never run farther than a half marathon. And here she is running a 100-mile race. Now, if that isn't just run, I don't know what is. And she ran a good race. She finished in 27 hours, which is a really respectable time in 100. Even if you don't finish, if you do one of these long races, what the heck? You'll have had a wonderful. Actually, I'm talking about advanced stuff now. We'll get to that later. Oh, I should also say, who am I kidding? Running in any weather. I'm just like you. I like running in perfect conditions. Okay. Ignoring conventional wisdom. In some respects, I think a lot of people are looking for shortcuts to their running career. They think, oh, if only I can, you know, find the right stretch or CrossFit, I'll be a great runner. And almost all of these, I'll say, the answer is just run. But I want to stress right ahead of time, because I know I have a coach here who probably disagrees with me, but I'm only trying to dispel the notion that these are necessary, not that they aren't good for you. And in particular, they might be of great benefit to some of you, some of these things. But you have to approach them with an open mind and say, is this really doing me any good? And All of these things that I'm going to talk about are conventional wisdom, where runners say, you have to do this, and I don't do any of them. And, well, the proof's in the pudding. Stretching. Everybody stretches. I found that the more I stretched, the more I got injured. And when I stopped stretching, I stopped getting injured. Some bodies just aren't made to be stretched, and mine's one of those. It's just not something I can do. Cross-training. Well, my opinion on that is it just takes time away from running. I mean, the best training for running is running itself. And sure, cross-train if you enjoy doing that stuff, but certainly isn't necessary to become a better runner. Flexibility. When I first hired my coach, he gave me a flexibility test. You know, if he didn't score it from 0 to 100%, but if he had, I would have been about 5% on all of them, if not zero. I am just not flexible. So I said, Coach, I said, it's obvious I'm not flexible. Let's consider it a virtue. Because I am so inflexible, you know, I can't get out of good running form. You know, I'm locked in. And so he didn't fight it. Strengthening. You know, this can be muscle groups or core strengthening. I don't do any of that. In fact, I have this theory that if you try and go out and strengthen certain muscles, you'll probably just strengthen this one group and leave the others unstrengthened. So now you're all out of balance, and you're more likely to get injured because these strong muscles then make the weak muscles work harder than they should. And personally, if I get on a weight lifting regime, I'll do 10 reps, you know, and then 15. And I say, well, I've done 15, now I have to add a little weight. And I go back down to 10 and build up a 15. Thing is, I never stop until I've injured myself. So, you know, and that's going to happen at some point. So some people just can't lift weight safely, and I'm one of them. Other people think it's all in the mind. All you do is get the right thoughts and you'll be a great runner. And, well, I don't know. I just don't have that problem. I mean, I thoroughly enjoy running, and quitting never enters my mind, so I don't have to deal with it that much. Mental focus for me only kind of comes maybe in the depths of a 200-miler where you're really tired and you look and you realize you've still got a day and a half to go. Or it's more likely to happen in a 100-miler when you've hit the wall and you've still got 30 miles to go. And what I tell myself when I'm feeling really terrible is, this is why I do this. And that's absolutely true. I mean, why would you do this if you couldn't bring yourself to the point that nobody else but a very small percentage of the population is going to reach that point? And so that's why I do it. At the end of a 200-miler, even, I don't have mantras much, but I do have this one thing to help me get through the last few miles. I'll start chanting to myself, I run, I run, I run is what I do. I run, I run, I run is what I do. It's really hard to walk when you do that. So that's why I do it. Electrolytes. Oh, some people subscribe to this salt replacement theory. If you sweat out the salt, you got to take it back in. That's just total hogwash. For almost everybody, taking electrolytes is a total waste of money. I mean, you only need electrolytes to keep the salt balance in your blood. And 4 billion years of evolution has taken care of that for you. Your body knows how to keep your blood chemistry right, and you've got enough salt reserves, you know, to last for ages. You're not going to run out of salt in a marathon, and longer than that, you're going to hit aid stations every now and then. You're going to get all the salt you need. So I see people just gobble like, you know, a dozen an hour. It's just unbelievable. Not to say that maybe some people can avoid cramps that way. The jury is still out whether electrolytes have anything to do with cramps. But, I took them because conventional wisdom told me to, and then I stopped taking them, and I noticed absolutely no difference. Diet. People say, do you have a special diet? Oh, yeah, I have a special diet. What is it? It's the seafood diet. So, I mean, you put food in front of me, I see it down the hatch. Yeah. The only other nutrition thing I think is important is that I never eat before or during a run. I think that's real. People say, no, you've got to eat so you'll have the strength to do a good workout. But I think particularly for endurance running, if you don't eat and during or before a run, then you're teaching your body to store glycogen, which is the energy you really need to perform effectively. And it teaches you to burn your fat more efficiently. And I do, you know, both of those things, I think, a lot better than most people. And I really attribute it to that fact. And the third reason is, boy, breakfast tastes good when you're done. So, common ailments. Nausea, cramps, inability to recover between races, and the actual pain of racing. People are always looking for some magic way to avoid these things. I was certainly one with nausea. I discovered that every time I ran 35 miles or longer, I got sick. And I looked up all the remedies, ginger and proper hydration and electrolytes. It turned out that all I needed to do was, well, just run. I had to get in better shape. Nausea is your body's way of telling you that you're exceeding its capabilities. And your stomach says, well, if you're not going to slow down, I am going to slow you down. And believe me, nausea slows you down. And it's, but ever since I got in better shape, I can run, you know, ultras of any distance now, and almost never suffer nausea unless it's, you know, added factors like being really, really hot, you know, where it's tough to take in the nutrients that you need. All right, that's Just Run 101. I guess I was supposed to click this every now and then. Okay, just now we go to Just Run 201. All right, there are exceptions. And so here are some of the exceptions that prove the rule. I don't know why that counts. But one is, you could argue that you should just run. Who needs a coach? But as I've already said, this changed my whole life when I hired a coach. That's my coach there in the picture. And the next question is, well, what did your coach make you do? And there's two things. You know, he makes you do the right workouts, and which are much harder than I would assign for myself. After having my coach for 7 years, I would still not be able to assign myself the workouts that he gives me. I would just say, well, there's no way I can do that. But the reason I can do it is the accountability. He gives me these workouts to do, and by golly, I'm gonna do them. And you know, I'd rather die than report back to my coach that I couldn't do his workout. So coaching is just really important. And it's a life lesson, too. It isn't just coaching or running. If you want to get good at anything, you know, why try and rediscover everything about it yourself? Find an expert who can teach you these things, and you won't regret it. I told this story to my brother-in-law, who is a rock climber, really good rock climber. But he says, he's right, I'm going to hire a coach. And he did, and he learned all kinds of things about the sport that he thought, you know, that he didn't even know that they were things to think about. Racing nutrition. Well, used to be I hardly ate anything in a marathon, but this stuff you've probably heard about, Martin, it is a wonder fuel for a marathon. I'm not sure how useful it is for shorter races. You might want to experiment with it, but it is amazing stuff. It used to be I could eat maybe 300 calories during a marathon, and even then I would start getting queasy and sick. But with this stuff, at Jacksonville, I went through 900 calories of this stuff, and I even felt hungry toward the end of the race. It is amazing stuff. It kind of gets out of your stomach and into your intestines, and it's your stomach that sends out those nausea signals, and wonderful stuff. I don't think I could have broken the world record without that. And then there's technology such as Garmin watch and then the Nike shoes. They're both just truly amazing. The watch, of course, keeps me on track during a marathon, but I just use it in training. I'm I'm really married to my watch. I think my wife wishes I were paid to her as much attention as I do to my watch. But when I run with my watch, you know, my watch and I are joined at the hip. Well, joined at the wrist anyway. And the Nike shoes, they're really light. You hold them in your hand, you can hardly feel them. But as soon as you put them on, it feels like foam this thick. And you can't help but think, I am going to run a PR today. So I'm not a total Luddite. I don't just run when it comes to competition. I take advantage of the real silver bullets. All right, we're up to Just Run 301. Okay, this is really advanced stuff here. Extreme endurance runs. How does Just Run apply to running an extreme endurance run? The most applicable case, I guess, is a race I did earlier this year. I ran a 24-hour race on a track, round and round. I ended up doing almost 500 laps on the track in that 24 hours. And you're constantly coming back, you know, every minute and a half or 2 minutes, you're coming back to a place where you could quit. And so you have to somehow get your mind into this just run feeling where the rest of the world disappears and quitting isn't an option. If quitting is an option, eventually you're going to take it. But if it isn't an option, you get back to the starting line and you just repeat whatever you've done over and over and over again. That's the only thing that's gotten me through those loop races is getting into that state of mind. Quick recovery. Well, some people consider that my superpower. They say, how can you run races every weekend? And you might say, every weekend? Well, not quite. But I ran 43 races last year. And at one point, I ran 15 races in a row. And it was during that stretch where I got most of those national records and championships. I just kept getting stronger every week. And it's because I think you can train, your body responds to how you train it. And I train by racing every weekend. And eventually my body just gives in and says, okay, if you're going to race every weekend, we'll make that possible. Other examples of quick recovery. The first time I broke 3 hours in a marathon was at Rotterdam. And I ran a 2:57 there. And the next weekend, I won my age group at Boston. So at the world record in Jacksonville. And I'm saying, pointing these out, just to show you how conventional wisdom can be so, so wrong. What's the conventional wisdom on racing? You should rest one day for every mile of the race or something. I mean, totally ridiculous. And no book is going to suggest what I did 2 weeks before the Jacksonville race, which was I ran a 50K on Saturday and I ran a hard marathon on Sunday. 2 weeks before a world record attempt. And I ran a 5K hard race the next week. There isn't any book in the world will say you should, you know, that's the way to train. But, you know, it might work. If you like racing, race. Your body will come around to the idea. Earlier this year, I ran a 50-miler, a 50-miler, a 100-miler, and a 200-miler, all in a 7-week period. I didn't know if I could do it. I was trying to beat the year before where I did my 3 200s, and I was trying to figure out how could I beat that this year. And so I decided to try that. And, it didn't matter whether I failed or not. I was definitely going to go out there and try. And it worked. Saturday, Sunday marathons. I do those. I'll go out and run Saturday marathon, and sometimes my Sunday marathon will be faster. I always try and win my age group in a marathon, so I'm not out there just seeing if I can do two long runs in the weekend. I'm out there trying to race two times in a weekend. I've done that several times. It's your body responds to how you train it. So if you train well, you can run well. Okay, how to become advanced. Well, you say, well, what steps can I take to do such crazy things? Stage races. Oh, they're just so wonderful. You get to travel to some wonderful locale, and at first you look at it and say, 140 miles in a week? I can't run that far. But you'd be amazed at how far you can go when you get out and do something like that. In fact, I can almost guarantee it, by the end of that week, you'll be running stronger than you were at the beginning of the week, which sort of calls into the question of why you need rest. But I haven't dismissed rest days as part of my conventional wisdom that I'm ditching. But it is true, in a stage race, you can just keep on getting better. And why else are they good? You're running with other runners, you know, doing this, and you're camping out with them at night or something like that. The cutoffs are usually really generous. I mean, they give you practically all day to run a stage. And each stage is maybe only 20 miles, but they'll give you all, the whole daylight hours to do it. And so you can come in and do it as slow as you want. So it's great fun, the scenery and the training, and what it teaches your body to do is to run on short rest periods. I really credit doing adventure runs and stage races with, you know, prepping me for ultra marathons. Each year, I've done about six or seven of them now, and each year I picked one a little longer than the one before. The longest one I did was a 240-mile stage race in Scotland. And, since then I've done a 240-mile race that wasn't a stage race, just an endurance race. But the stage races helped get me there. Now, suppose you don't want to travel that far, but still would like to know how you can run long. Races against time are great. These you kind of have to look up. They're all over the place, but they're not all so popular you'd hear about them. That's one where you have a certain number of hours to run as far as you can, 12 hours, 24 hours. Heck, they have 48 hours, 96-hour races, and so on. And you can just go and run any distance you want. There's no failing there. You just quit when you feel like it, although, you know, I obviously encourage you to try and last the whole time and see how you can do it. I wasn't any good at those first. I think I only did 50-some miles the first time and maybe 80 the next. And now I can run 100 miles in under 24 hours. How else? Well, here's my favorite, the enter button. Go out there and enter as many races as you can. Of course, this is advanced stuff. Now, this is just run 301. There's a prerequisite for just run 301. And that's most likely is that in order to just run, you're going to have to just retire. So, yeah. I mean, I know most of you can't do this. You've got other lives. I mean, whereas obviously this one's my main one. So let's go on. Oh, I forgot to hit the button again. All right. Just run 401, the benefits, social, health, and lifestyle. I've made so many new friends since I started running. It's just wonderful. Of course, most of them are kind of virtual. You know, I only know them on Facebook. You know, well, my wife says I spend way too much time on Facebook. You know, I mean, well, who doesn't, maybe? But that's where my running community is. And I'm out there proselytizing and, you know, answering advice and just chatting with friends and asking them, you know, what they're going to do. I get lots of good ideas for other races that way. Socially, runners are the best people. I mean, I kid you not. Remember I said I gave up bowling? I just couldn't find bowlers I liked. I mean, really. And with golf, it's kind of hit or miss. You know, there's some really great golfers, but a lot of them, they're also people I just don't like associating. But runners, you can go to a race and you can chat up anybody, and they're going to be friendly. and you're going to really enjoy their company. I mean, it's just unbelievable that running attracts a really high quality type person. I'm way past my bar hopping age, but if I were back looking for a date, I'd go running. I mean, take today, for instance. I just went out running, and I ended up running with, you know, a dozen beautiful girls. So social is just great. But let's take a look, a little deeper dive into health and lifestyle. The health benefits of running. Question number one, doesn't running hurt your knees? You know, total myth. Running does not hurt your knees. For two things, I mean, it helps get blood flow to your knees. And it strengthens them. I mean, it keeps them healthy. And my other personal theory is that if you build up gradually with running, pretty soon your muscles protect your knees. When you're pounding there, all that shock is being absorbed by your muscles, and your knees don't have to take that as much anymore. A lot of people say, I can't run because my knees hurt. And I'm guessing that in a lot of cases, you know, that may be true. But in a lot of other cases, all they have to do is just start walking, gradually improve running. And at some point, the muscles will protect their knees and their knees will start getting better. My knees are better now than they were 15 years ago when I started running. They hurt much less. So let's dispel that myth right off the bat. Let's talk about longevity, depression, heart, cancer, dementia. I've just recently read articles on all these things. Every one of them says running is really great for these things. Of course, I've read an equal number of articles says running is terrible for all these things. But I think you've heard of positive confirmation bias. That's how you should read these articles. Read the ones that you agree with, you know. And there's lots to find there in these cases. I mean, I think clearly, you know, everybody knows it strengthens your heart. But all you do is have somebody drop dead at a marathon, and all the naysayers will come out and say, there, see, you know, running isn't good for you. You know, staving off dementia, cancer. Some people can find ways to ascribe running to benefits in all these. In other words, some people think running is a miracle cure. Now, I had said that I was going to ask at one point how we're doing on time. Oh, I mean, I've got time. Okay, I'm going to digress a little here and throw out a personal theory about longevity. I mean, there are some studies that show you live a little longer because of running, but I have a different kind of a theory. There are like five major theories out there about why we have a limited lifespan. I mean, it's clear genetics controls longevity. I mean, tortoises live 200 years, and some insects live, you know, 30 days. And dogs live 14 years. Humans live about 70. I mean, it isn't just chance that everybody lives the same age. It's because your genetics controls it. Now, how is that? It seems counterintuitive. Everybody thinks, well, evolution is survival of the fittest. So why hasn't evolution shaped us so that we're fertile all the time and live forever? I mean, what could be better for the individual than that? But it's clearly not the way evolution has arrived. It's not the solution evolution has arrived at. And it turns out this guy's theory is that because probably certain organisms did arrive at that solution way back when, you know, in the first billion years when evolution was trying out all kinds of different things. And anything that lived forever multiplied, and pretty soon the population crashed because they outlived their resources. I mean, somebody had likened it to you release a bunch of cows on an island and the, you know, the grass is lush and the huge population explosion, but then all of a sudden there isn't enough grass. Now, the entire herd will die out because they've stripped the island, and that's what's happened. And evolution has figured that out, and so it programs species to die off before they can consume all their resources. And now, the second part of that is you've all heard of how calorie restriction has allowed animals to live longer lifespans than the normal lifespan. You know, the jury's out on whether it works for humans, but it seems to work in almost any other lab animal they've tried it on. If they give them 60% or 40% or something of a normal thing, they might be miserable, but they live longer. And the reason for that is, again, evolution has tried to get it so your species is maximizing its potential. And if times are good, you're in danger of consuming all your resources. So it allows you to die off because, I mean, if times are good, you don't need to propagate and so on. And if times are bad, well, then it has to try and keep you alive because, you know, perhaps a lot of your cohort is dying off. Now, the way my personal theory now is that when I run these endurance runs, I'm faking it so my body thinks times are hard. I mean, times are hard, but only for a day or two. But I still think I'm impressing on my body that, look, you've got to stay alive for as long as possible because times are hard. I mean, what could be harder than what you're doing? And, it's my theory and I'm sticking to it. You heard it here first. I haven't read this anywhere. Lifestyle benefits of running. Oh, a lot of people do races, but they don't seem to time together with vacations. These are what I really look forward to. I had vacations with my kids where we would go out and do hikes and runs together. And I told my wife once, I'd like to go to Iceland and run a race. And she says, oh, Iceland, yeah, right, that's going to be a lot of fun. And it turned out it was just wonderful. I mean, I thoroughly can't hardly recommend Iceland as a nice vacation spot. The scenery is incredible. So I went out there and ran a race with my wife. And she went from doubtful to telling me to go down every possible side road to see the scenery. Destination races, they're just great. Running with family is great, of course. I'm not telling you to browbeat your kids into running, but, usually they'll want if you're lucky, they'll want to run with you. And I ran a couple marathons with my daughter earlier this year, and she said, Dad, we got to do this more often. So we're going to run 4 marathons together next year. And we're going to get together with my older daughter and run the 3 of us will run a marathon together. And finally, we have sort of a retirement option. A lot of people say, how can I run as good as you when I get old? Well, I have a funny answer to that. And the answer just might be, don't run. Well, not don't run. Just run, but don't race. I say, why would you want to compete against young guys and gals who are out there you're going to be competing against Olympic hopefuls. But if you wait until retirement, just kind of run easy and don't burn yourself out. Well, then you get as old as I am, you know, half your competition is 6 feet under, you know. And it's a lot easier. And I mean, they say no matter when you begin running hard, you've only got 15 good years. So do you want to spend those 15 years, you know? Nah, I'd rather get old and, you know, kick the occasional young butt myself. So wait for the time to be right. And another thing is, it becomes a lifestyle issue. I see a lot of people who are sacrificing, you know, job time, family time, and whatever, to go out and run. Just run, but don't get that wrapped up in it that you're using up your 15 years because, you know, wait until, the mortgage is paid off, the kids are gone, or even retire. I mean, it's okay to take the long-range view of it when you're young. Just say, yeah, I can have a lot of fun running, but if I want to really make it competitive, I'm going to wait until I get older. It'll work. So stay in shape. I'm not saying give up running, because I ran my whole life just as a jogger, and I credit that. I mean, I just wouldn't be as good as I am now if I had run hard earlier. There is one exception. Joan Benoit Samuelson. She was at the top of her game, way back when, winning Boston and other marathons. And, of course, on an absolute basis, she's not as good as she was, but she is still number one in the world for her age group. Just an incredible longevity thing for somebody as talented as she is. See, I couldn't have run that well when I was young. I mean, I'm just able to do it when I'm old. Tips on getting started running. Okay. That doesn't apply to the people in the front row, our esteemed runners. Maybe some of you out there are thinking about taking up running or have tried and given up. My main tip is a lot of people give up because, oh, it is so hard that first time you go out there. You're out of breath, everything hurts, and you think, well, if it hurts that much to run this slowly, how is it going to feel when I run faster? And I'm here to tell you, the faster you run, the better you'll feel. My first marathons, I could barely walk for a week afterwards. Now, when I run my fastest marathons ever, I'm ready to run the next weekend, I'll start training within a couple days. It's because when you really get in shape, the more you run, the better it'll be. Gradual improvement. Start slow. One of the favorite things I did whenever I moved to a new town is I got out a map, mapped out, say, like a four-mile route, and then said, okay, when I'm done with that, then I'm going to add on a little more and go 6 miles and 8 miles. And someday I'm going to get out and do something really long. And whenever I passed that point where the next loop would be, that inspired me to get good enough to go down that road that I've never been down before. The voyage of discovery was, and I really didn't know where some of these roads went, but I saw them on the map and just couldn't wait to see the scenery. So you start gradual, might even just walking, but all you have to do is every week or month or day or whatever, you promise yourself you're going to go a little farther or a little faster. And it's amazing what can happen just by promising you're going to do a little more than the day before. At one point, 10 miles was something I could barely wrap my head around. Now I run 200 miles. I didn't get there in one step. It was because every year I just tried to go a little farther than the year before. And it can take you just amazing places. The other way is, another important thing is, okay, so, I'm competing against, stiff competition, but my fiercest competitor is myself. That's the person I want to beat. The guy I was yesterday or last month or last year. And everybody can compete against themselves. No matter what your level, you can always promise yourself you're going to do better than you did last time. And if you're getting older and running's going downhill, it can be on a relative basis. I mean, they have things called age-graded scores, and you can find out how you're doing relative to your age. Yeah, I've already mentioned nutrition, that I think when you start training, it's important not to eat before or during a run. I think you'll find that you'll store a lot more energy that way. So here's what I'd have missed if I hadn't just run. I'm going to show you some. Here's what you're all waiting for, the pretty pictures. So this was my first adventure run in Patagonia in 2008. Took the family down. Two of us ran around these mountains, and my other daughter and my wife hiked. And what a great vacation. The next year, my daughter and I went on another adventure run around Lake Tahoe. An adventure run is just like a stage race where you don't do it all in one day, and somebody else takes care of taking all of your equipment to the next place. And, what a great way to run. You don't have to worry about the logistics. You get to just run. Then I went and ran the Wonderland Trail. That's the trail that runs around Mount Rainier. It's about 93 miles long. Incredible scenery. I mean, here it shows me at one of the areas. It goes over like 7 or 8 different passes, and every one of them is different scenery, and each one is just unbelievably gorgeous. The only way to see it in a short time is to go out there and run. Here are some more. This is the Laugaveger. It's usually a losing proposition to try and pronounce any Icelandic word. So I hope I haven't butchered that too bad. But look at this scenery. Where are you going to see that running in Pennsylvania, right? You know, volcanoes, lava flows, geysers, you name it. It's out there. Incredible scenery. And then this was my first stage race, Trans Rockies Run. It was 6 days of running from one point to point. And here was another one, the Desert Rats. Remember how I said you can train yourself? Your body will respond to however you want to train yourself. And I was having trouble in the heat. So I intentionally signed up for the Desert Rats stage race, which was a race from Grand Junction, Colorado to Moab. And in between there, it's pretty much just desert. It was 115 degrees at the finish line. I have never had trouble with heat since. I perform on a relative basis much better in the heat than other people. My body responded. I trained it to run in the heat. It came through. The Transalpine race. Oh, boy, what scenery I saw there. 8 days in the Alps. We ran through 4 countries going from Germany to Italy. Austria and Switzerland being the two in between. The Fat Dog, that's in British Columbia. It's 120 miles, and that's the Hurricane Ridge in Washington that you can see across the border there. That race, interesting enough, was the longest I've run without sleep. It had a 48-hour cutoff. And I came in at 47 hours and 30 minutes or so. No, it was 48 and a half. So I ran 48 straight hours without a break and just barely made the cutoff. But it was incredible. Well, you might think, how can you possibly function running that long without sleep? Well, I think the answer is that you don't have to have a lot of brain power when you run. In fact, you know, it might even be counterproductive because your brain, if it were fully functional, would talk you out of doing that. Cape Wrath, that's the long stage race I did in Scotland. Incredible scenery up there. Zion, I did a 100K race just outside Zion. Unfortunately, this picture was taken from inside the park. You're not allowed to run races in national parks, so they're always just outside. So if you see a race for the Grand Canyon or Bryce or so on, you're not going to be running in the park. But I'm going back this year to do something called the Zion Traverse next year with some friends, just as a kind of a bucket list iconic trail run. It's a 55-mile race or route across the heart of the Zion Canyon, and a lot of the scenery will be just like that. I mean, what could be better than running with friends through scenery like that? You get to see the most amazing moments in 200-mile races. You get to see 4 sunsets and 4 sunrises, and frequently they're all amazing. Here was a sunset at Lake Tahoe. I haven't seen one like that ever. Some amazing moments are not quite so fun. This was from the River of No Return up in Idaho. And one of the hardest races I've done because it kept going from 5,000 feet up to 9,000 feet. And when I got past 8,000 feet, the snow was this thick, and it was so hard. And we got to this one trail. You see the pink flags. Normally it shows you where you're going. We got to this one stream, and we looked for a pink flag on the other side. Do you see the flag? No, I don't see it. So then we looked upstream, and there go the pink flags, going right through the river for about 50 yards. And I think we both looked at each other and said, "Are you shitting me?" Man, so much beauty out there. Here's Bigfoot, my favorite race of all. That's Mount St. Helens in the background. And as you can see, up here there's a few trees. I think that's a stump there, though. And this is over 10 miles from the volcano, which exploded, about 50 years ago. Everything out there is still devastated. Normally after a forest fire, trees just grow right back up, right? They're designed to deal with that. But the heat is so intense in the volcanic eruption, it just incinerated everything, seeds, whatnot. And what it didn't incinerate, it buried. And so we run through that devastation zone for about half the race. And then the second half of the race, we're running through a deep, old forest growth, moss and just amazing. Here's a view just after sunrise one day. I think that's probably Mount Hood there in the distance. And a few months later, I did Moab. That was a 240-mile race. And one of my rules for running these races is you run when you can, walk when you can't, and nap when you have to. But this is one of the biggest, best reasons for not running. When you come across a viewpoint like this, you just got to stop and take it all in. So I ran out of 200 milers in the U.S. to do. So I had to start looking abroad. And there were these guys in Australia who ran this same triple crown of 200s that I did. And they said, we've got to get races going like that. And their first one was earlier this year, which they called the Delirious West. 200-mile race near Perth, running mostly along the Southern Ocean. And, just great. I mean, what could be more fun than dodging venomous snakes and giant spiders? Just wonderful. All right. Who's been paying attention? The takeaways. Just run. Number two. There is no number two. You're never, never too old to run. I think some of these may have been mentioned earlier. Here's Ed Whitlock. He's a really famous runner. He lived in Toronto. He was one whose world record I broke. But don't feel sorry for him. The record stands, Ed Whitlock, in terms of world records, it's Ed Whitlock 35. Gene won. So, his legacy is quite secure. I can beat his marathons, but I can't beat any of his others. He was wickedly fast. He has world records in half marathon, 10K, 5K. I can't even dream of running that fast. And somebody who ran at 104. Here's somebody recently ran the Rock and Roll Marathon at age 92. People often ask, what's your lifetime goal in running? And I think it's to win my age group at Boston, but not any old age group. I want to win the 120 to 124 age group. So that's my lifetime goal. I think that's it. If I left anything out, I'm sorry, but here's your chance.
We'll now begin the question and answer session. Since the event is being recorded, please raise your hand and wait for the mic to get to you before asking your question. Also, as an undergraduate institution, we'll reserve the first questions for students. We'll now take the first question.
At the River of No Return, it looked like you had a pretty big pack on. What kind of stuff did you have in your backpack?
For the River of No Return?
Yes.
Let's see. I probably had, what you wear is depending on how often the aid stations are and how long you expect to be traveling between them. And I've done 100 milers where I just wear a single bottle hip belt because that's enough to get from one aid station to the other. River of No Return, I probably wore a maybe a 10-liter pack or something. Well, particularly because I didn't know what kind of weather I was going to run into. And you can't be up there when you're running in the mountains, and you can't be 100, you have to be 110% certain that you're not going to run into some kind of snowstorm, because mountains make their own weather. So for a race like that, where you don't know what kind of weather you're running into, I undoubtedly had a pack big enough to carry several layers of clothing. Usually, food-wise, I probably just would have had a couple snack bars in there, because I would load up at the aid stations. And that also allowed me to have, in addition to my bottle, I would have had two bottles on my pack. And, you might think, well, what do you drink? I used to drink water, but I found water kind of boring. And so now I drink Coke. But I can't drink... At my first 100-miler, I tried to drink Coke, and I drank it straight. And I think, boy, my stomach felt burned out for a whole week afterwards. But so it turns out if you dilute it 50-50 with water, you get all the benefits without the acidic afterglow. Coke is great stuff. I don't know why they don't sponsor me. I just always just say the greatest things about Coke. It gets me through a lot of races. Good question, by the way, because good questions are ones I know the answer to.
You race in the Vaporflies, but what's your favorite training shoe?
My favorite training shoe? I don't have one. I'm blessed with feet that can just fit in about any kind of shoes. I'm currently wearing a Brooks and Mizuno, and I have some New Balances. I pretty much, whenever I see a good deal, I'll get a shoe, which means I have about 20 pairs of shoes, which I haven't even run in yet. Nikes for the really important races, and just about any good training shoe for other things. Just have to find out, nobody should take my advice. You've got to get out there and find out what fits your feet. But it's true that my feet can fit in about anything. One of the really hard things about doing 100-mile races is people get blisters, and I don't know if I could stand that. I mean, I hear lots of stories about people. I've seen them at aid stations, and they come in and their whole foot is just blistered away. And I can't imagine how they do it, but I don't get blisters, so I'm really lucky that way.
Hi. So it seems like you have a lot of experience from your longer races running through the night. So do you have any tips for running at night?
Tips for running at night? Well, the main thing is I really like running at night. I mean, it's just, it's a whole new world. To some extent, I've mentioned how I love the voyage of discovery. Well, when you're running at night, all you can see is what you see by your flashlight. You don't know what's coming up until you're close to it. So that's a lot of fun. You will slow down a little, you want to make sure you're footing. But if you're worried that, I'll fall asleep in the middle of the night, that's pretty rare when you talk to somebody who has to take a nap during a 100-mile race. It's not like an all-nighter. I mean, you guys have all done all-nighters, right? By the morning, you can't function, right? But it's not like that in running. You can just keep going and just crash something awful afterwards. But during the run, you never feel sleepy. During a 200-mile race, yes. I'll go on to say that in a 200-mile race, it would take me 5 days and 4 nights. And sleep deprivation can just come over you like a tidal wave. One minute you're running fine, and then all of a sudden your vision goes and you're hallucinating, and it's all you can do to keep running. But you're in the middle of the wilderness, and stopping isn't an option. So you have to keep going. But that's part of the fun.
Yeah.
I don't think you need to practice it, is what I'm saying. You know, just go out and do it. Just run. I might say that most people wear headlamps, and I think that's a bad idea. There are a lot of alternatives out there these days. Used to be that was the only thing. I mean, I even like a handheld. But the reason headlamps aren't any good is because it's right at the same level as your eyes. And, you know, your life depends on not tripping over that rock or root out ahead of you. And if the light is just out in the same line of sight as your eyes, you're not going to see the shadows. It's the shadows that you see. So when I carry a light down here, I get these big, long shadows on all the obstacles. So I would say, even if you carry a headlamp, also carry a handheld or a waist lamp, something that can cast shadows. You'll be a lot safer.
When you decided to choose a coach, the picture was small, but it looked like the coach was quite a bit younger than you are. Did you consider a coach closer to your age, and why did you go with the younger coach?
Oh, that's interesting. I found my coach by Googling Philadelphia running coach. I got a couple hits, you know, including some hits from people not from Philadelphia. I didn't get as many hits as I expected. It really came down to just 1 or 2, and he was the clear choice. So I guess restricted choice applies there. But I was worried that maybe he wouldn't know how to treat an old guy. And so I was kind of a little resistant when I first saw his workouts and said, wait a minute, you're going to have me running 6 days a week, hard every day? I'm an old guy. I need to rest between workouts. That's the way I've always done it. But he wasn't having any of that. Really, the secret to my elevation in running was running on tired legs. When you train on tired legs, you're really giving them the workout that takes you to the next level. So if he wasn't an expert on old people, I guess maybe he is now. So he changed my life, and I changed his. Before, he just did a few online clients. Most of his job was, you know, doing stuff in the gym, you know, personal fitness type stuff. Now he's got more online clients than knows what to do with, and a lot of them are old like me, and people would say, look, and this is what I really love, is to see people out there say, I've seen what you can do, and I want to get out there and go better, and that's always what I'm trying to do, encourage people to get out there and they thought they couldn't, and a lot of them end up hiring John, and he's just so incredible. I knew within a month or so that, you know, he was something special because he knew way better than I did what I could do. I mean, and I would reach the end of the workouts knowing that if he designed just one more mile or 10 seconds per mile faster that I would have totally failed. But somehow he always knew exactly what would bring me, you know, to my limit and not over. Just an amazing guy. Yours was a two-part question. Did I get both parts?
Why didn't you choose
the older coach? Yeah, right. Restricted choice. I didn't have much choice. It turned out that I guess what I discovered is that good advice is kind of universal. Old people can do the same thing. His key metric was how fast can you run a 10K? He based his initial training off that. So he gave the workouts to improve from there.
Before I ask my question, have we exhausted all the undergraduate questions at this point? Because I'm going to be a postgraduate questioner here. So you've very humbly explained your philosophy of running and just kind of thrown caution to the wind and just did it. I'm a little curious if you've ever had any testing done, scientific or exercise physiology, to see if there's actually something different about your body's makeup or DNA that has helped you reach these amazing points in your life.
Well, It's interesting. I ran into a guy. I just got a call from my brother who got lost trying to find tickets. He drove right through the middle of Carlisle and kept on going. I'll call you back. I hope that wasn't active when I said that. I mean, total space cadets. Anyway, all right, what was the question? You've got to put up testing. Senior moments here. Oh, testing, yes. To start out, how am I doing on time here? About 10 years ago, I was running one of my early marathons. It was the first time I hoped to win my age group in a road marathon. It was called the Pocono Road to the Bay. And indeed, I did win my age group. I had just turned 60. And the reason I won my age group was because the 72-year-old guy was not in my age group. He was in the next one, or two more. He was, and I said, it's just amazing. He had run Boston a few weeks earlier. Any chance that I can be as good as you? And he said, no. He says, because if you could be as good as me, you'd already be that good. And your genes would have shown that. So I believed him. Genetically, if I look at my family, nobody else knows Daniel Browns. Certainly doesn't run my hand. Both my kids run, I've done marathons. So I get a little genetic factor there. Yeah, it has to be, because there's slow twitch muscles and fast twitch muscles. I think I'm like two-thirds slow twitch and one-third fast twitch. It allows me to compete effectively at the 5K after marathons, but faster than 5K. I can compete. It is really hard. So, this has to be some genetic time. But I've known people who, in my running group, they get out there and they ran every weekend just like I did, and they never got any better. I mean, some people don't have the physiology. I don't know why. Now, why in particular have I done so well? Yes, I was talking by some folks at the University of Delaware about a year ago. And they put me on a treadmill and did things like VO2 max and running economy and so on. Remember, I've said I've had some really visible experiences, right? Well, there's nothing worse than doing those tests on a treadmill. When you run, whether it's training or a race, it usually ends up with some sort of success. You finish the race, you finish the workout. When you're on a treadmill doing a test, they test until you fail. All tests end in failure. You just, no matter how much you know you gave it your last ounce, within 5 seconds of the workout ending, you're just killing yourself. Why couldn't I run a little harder? You will. Anyway, what did they find out? They found out something which matches what I see in my time, which is the ability to run at, not to meet the yard, but I don't know, something like the ability to run at VO2 max for a lot longer than other people can. Which is what I see. This rule of thumb, you take your half marathon time, double it, and add 10 or 20 minutes or something. If you double my half marathon, which wasn't exactly slow, it's a national record for my age group, but my marathon time is just double that and add 2 minutes. So I run my marathon almost as fast as I run a half marathon. And my 15K is now a whole lot faster than that. So, once I reach a certain level, I can maintain it for a long time. That seems to be something unusual about me. I don't think they said why, how you can develop that. Although, people say, what's different about you? There is something very clearly different about how I approach marathon training.
No other marathoner I know of runs ultras. And I run lots of them, you know, like 100 miles, 200 miles. And I do lots of them every year. And but still, I can get on your marathon course and set records. And I think it's because, you know, first, when I signed up for these ultras, when I hired my coach, I'm sure he went up to the nearest wall and, you know, you're supposed to be training for marathons. But he's come around thinking, there's definitely some benefit in this. It builds an incredible base. So when I train for marathons, I don't have to work on endurance. I can work strictly on speed. And I don't have to worry about it. And clearly, endurance applies to this ability to just keep going and going and going at the same pace. So that's so a little bit of genetics and a lot of the style of training, I think, is what's in the car.
We have time for one more question.
Hi, how are you? It's not a question, but I really admire your attitude, and I have to go now, but can I get a hug before I go?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the
end of that. No, can I get a hug before I go?
So that wasn't a question. I will. I'm just curious, apart from your competitive success, is there anything that's changed over time in the kind of the nature of your of the emotional satisfactions you get from running?
I've been kind of constant because I've always stuck to this thing of each year I want to do something a little more gonzo than last year. And so each year I try and do that. And when I succeed, then I have the same satisfaction I had the year. I beat that guy from the year before. You know, I beat what he did. And so far, you know, obviously I'm not going to keep getting better on an absolute basis too much longer. It's been 13 years that I've been improving. And, but then, obviously, I'll switch to doing things my age better than mine. Than I could. And, Ed Whitmacher, you know, he kept setting records for way more than 15 years. And so I've got that to look forward to, I hope. But I'll also tell people, you're only one injury away from retirement. you never know when it's going to strike.
That concludes tonight's event. Please join me in thanking our speaker, Jim Dixon.